Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, celebrating over 70 years of service to financial advisors, their clients, and institutions worldwide. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Drive them. Don't drive them. It's getting so Toyota owners don't know who to listen to. And the company's problems, well, they only seem to be getting bigger. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Progressive Insurance, helping people shop for car insurance at 1-800-PROGRESSIVE and progressive.com. And by Constant Contact, dedicated to helping small businesses and nonprofits build strong customer relationships with email marketing, online surveys, and event marketing. ConstantContact.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Wednesday today, the 3rd of February, and it is good to have you with us. Hard as this may be to believe, for a company that's in the middle of a record recall and that has stopped making and selling a huge chunk of its product line, but things somehow did manage to go from bad to worse for Toyota today. Talking to a House committee this morning, Transportation Secretary Ray LaHood said he knows exactly what Toyota owners ought to do with their cars.
Stop driving it, take it to the Toyota dealer, because they believe they have the fix for it.
It took about an hour for LaHood to come out and say that he had misspoken, but by then the damage was done, on a day when the damage seemed to keep on coming. Marketplace's Elisa Roth has been following the Toyota story for us. Hi, Elisa.
Hello.
Other than the transportation secretary changing his mind today about whether or not you ought to drive your Toyota, it has been a rough couple of days for this company.
That is true. Today, there's a lot of speculation out there that unintended acceleration is actually caused by a problem with electronics in the vehicles, and it's credible enough that the Transportation Department is reportedly looking into this. There have been reports that Toyota's woes go beyond accelerators. Some people are saying that 2010 Priuses are having trouble braking on slippery or uneven surfaces. Japan has ordered Toyota to look into the problem, and there have been complaints about it in the U.S. too. And finally, Toyota is saying today that it'll be giving money to dealers to help do the right thing with customers, so to pay for things like extended hours and free oil changes, things like that.
Yeah, depending on the size of the dealer, it's about, what, $75,000 or so. But it does raise this question. How much is this going to cost the company in the long run? Do we know?
Well, Toyota says it doesn't know. What we do know is that last month sales fell 16%. Goldman Sachs is saying that from now until March, it's going to cost the company $1.6 billion in lost sales and recall fixing. I've seen some estimates that go as high as $2 billion. Obviously, the two big questions are whether the fix really does solve the problem and whether people are still willing to buy Toyotas when this is all done.
Well, right. And we were talking about that at our morning meeting today, and nobody raised their hand when I said, hey, listen, are you going to buy one of these fixed cars? What about the general public?
It's really hard to know. For starters, those recalled cars aren't actually for sale right now. When Toyota does start selling them again, it's pretty clear that it'll have to offer some buyer incentives. That's something that Toyota has rarely done in the past. One analyst I talked to today said that in other auto recalls, it's taken a full generation, and I'm talking human generations here, not car generations, to recover. The other thing is that the media environment has changed completely since the last time we dealt with something like this. So if Congress holds all kinds of hearings about Toyota, we're going to know about it. And that's not something that would have happened in the past necessarily.
Well, is it possible, though, that that media environment is contributing to us worrying about the wrong thing, that we're all afraid that these 8 million Toyotas are all going to go crazy at the same time?
Absolutely. I mean, there is the point here that this recall is bigger in scope than a lot of past recalls. It involves multiple model years and multiple models. That said, like anything else, this is a bit of a numbers game. The National Highway Traffic Safety Administration, aka NHTSA, is saying that 5 people have died and only in 2 incidents that were a result of the floor mat problem, and that it hasn't confirmed any deaths from the accelerator pedal problem. One safety group out there is saying that this has been an ongoing problem for Toyota, that over the last decade there have been more than 2,000 episodes involving unintended acceleration, that 19 people have died as a result. But not to minimize the hurt for those families, even if you take those higher numbers, it's really more likely that you'll get run over crossing the street than that your Toyota is going to go crazy on you.
Elisa Roth at the Marketplace Bureau in New York. Elisa, thanks a lot.
You're welcome.
It may be tough to gauge how much this episode is going to cost the company, but Toyota shareholders are sure feeling it. The stock dropped another 6% today. One of the ways the Obama administration is trying to resuscitate the housing market is through what are called mortgage modifications, helping homeowners stay in their homes by reducing their monthly payments. Progress on that, though, has been slow, in part because banks and loan servicers who have to agree to modify those loans have been holding back. Now, there is some discussion that the Treasury Department might be tweaking some of the formulas that it uses to make those modifications easier. Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman explains.
When a struggling homeowner calls up to get a break on their monthly mortgage payment, the bank has a few choices, aside from doing nothing. It can reduce the interest rate, extend the life of the loan, or reduce the principal owed. But banks have been loath to do this last fix and risk losing out when the market recovers, says Desmond Lockman of the American Enterprise Institute.
If for some reason house prices were to rise in value, if the person who borrowed, their financial circumstances became better, the bank would still have the option of getting paid back the full amount.
Now, there are reports the Obama administration may tweak one of the financial formulas that lenders use to determine whether to write down the principal or foreclose.
What they're doing purely is to evaluate what's a better position for the lender and the investor. Is it better that we let the loan get modified, or do we just need to foreclose? So what in that equation is we're looking out for the homeowner. They're looking out for the investor.
South Carolina real estate lawyer Kathy Olivetti is seeing more and more homeowners willing to walk away from their mortgages. That's because they owe so much more than what the property is worth now.
We have got to start addressing principal reductions.
A new report from First American CoreLogic finds that people whose homes are worth 25% less than what they owe on the mortgage are much more likely to stop paying. 1 in 10 American homeowners will reach that point by June. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
The politics of energy were front and center at the White House today. President Obama met with 11 governors, many of them from coal-producing states, trying to get them to sign on to his energy policies and to shift away from fossil fuels. Sarah Gardner reports now from the Marketplace Sustainability Desk. The White House effort is not going so well.
Obama wants the country to use less oil and coal and more alternative energy. So he's pushing hard for tax credits for solar and wind and loan guarantees for nuclear. He also wants Congress to repeal billions in subsidies for oil, gas, and coal. Coal state lawmakers are already decrying the proposed changes as a jobs killer. Oil and gas companies are casting them as a new tax. Rayola Dewar is with the American Petroleum Institute.
It really will translate into less investment, fewer jobs, and especially fewer American jobs. And we think that is exactly the wrong way to go.
Obama hopes to win farm state support for his energy proposals by shoring up biofuels. Today, he announced a new plan aimed at boosting biofuel production. Matt Hartwig is at the Renewable Fuels Association.
The ultimate goal of the renewable fuel standard is in the year 2022 that the United States is using 36 billion gallons of renewable fuel.
Currently, the U.S. produces only a third of that. Some environmentalists criticize today's biofuels announcement. They say the EPA underestimates the global warming emissions from corn ethanol. I'm Sarah Gardner for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, some up, a touch more down. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. George Mason University economist Tyler Cowen makes no secret of his feelings about Haiti, both the country and its people.
To me, it's one of the places where there's some essential soul of humanity that's on display in Haiti, stronger than almost anywhere else I've been.
He has been there a number of times. He collects Haitian art and music. And thanks to a background in development economics, Cowen has become a student of Haiti's problems. The earthquake a couple of weeks ago has gotten him thinking and blogging about what to do now, how to get some kind of new economy going again. When we talked, before we got to that part, I asked him to put the old Haitian economy into context.
Haiti is a much poorer country than most people realize, but you have a country where there are very few recognizable brands. The Holiday Inn had closed down, McDonald's had pulled out. Most of it is subsistence economy.
Remittances and foreign aid, right? Remittances from overseas workers?
Remittances are about a quarter of gross national product, and without remittances, the place would collapse. There aren't that many large-scale structures. Most of civil society has been destroyed. A lot of the Haitian poor, they actually eat mud cakes for nutrition. So if a catastrophe comes along, the amount of slack there is very, very thin.
As we start to think about rebuilding Haiti physically, but also rebuilding its economy, what do we do? Where do we go?
Well, I wouldn't call it rebuilding. I would call it building. I think the first thing we need to do is to take in more Haitians in as many wealthy countries as possible. It's simply not possible to support the number of people in Haiti right now. There's no way to do it, no matter how well any aid program will go. So taking more immigrants also means more remittances. The next thing we need to do is attend to problems of sanitation and also worry about the Haitian planting season, which is due to start this spring. And that requires seed, fertilizer, a lot of infrastructure that tends to come through Port-au-Prince. And if the planting season doesn't get underway, that's about half of their food supply.
What has to be done first, though, Don?
I would say get some secure tents for people to live in so that when the next rain comes, it's not all washed away. Vaccinate children and attend to sanitation. You have several hundred thousand people living in a way where there's nowhere to put their waste. And for the first few days, maybe that's manageable. But after 3 months, it's not.
You've done some work in development economics, and I'm curious as to your thoughts on how all of this is supposed to happen. What is the mechanism by which any of this, whether it's secure tents or waste treatment systems, how's that going to work? How's it physically going to happen?
In the longer run, development has to happen locally. It has to come from Haitians. But I would say in the short run, some of the emergencies need to be addressed really by the U.S. military, by the UN, and by the Inter-American Development Bank. But if Haiti is to succeed in the longer run, it's not going to be up to anything we do. It will require a collective decision from the Haitians, really, simply that things are going to be different.
Haiti is a place that has a history of corruption, at least in modern times. How do we think about that as we try to get huge amounts of money and material in there?
I think Haiti will remain corrupt for the foreseeable future, but there are two kinds of corruption. One kind of corruption is where you shut out the outside world because it's a threat to you. Another kind of corruption is you let the outside world in because you can take a piece of the pie. If Haiti moves to that second mode of corruption, which is a lot like how China works or how South Korea worked in the 70s, that's actually the scenario for hope. If our vision is to drive all corruption from Haiti, that's unrealistic. What we need is a Haiti that's more commercial, more outward-looking, and more open to the rest of the world.
Seems like a lot of things have to go right for things to work out well for Haiti.
A lot of things have to go right, but Haiti has some remarkable assets, most of all its people, their creativity, potential for tourism, and Haitian reputation for good hard work. So I'm cautiously optimistic about the medium run.
Tyler Cowen is a professor of economics at George Mason University. He blogs at a site called Marginal Revolution. Tyler, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
AIG was back in the news today, and as is usually the case, it was not a flattering story about the insurance company that got $180 billion from taxpayers. We learned today that AIG is going to pay out another $100 million in bonuses. This morning, Treasury Secretary Timothy Geithner called those payments an outrageous failure of policy, and so he pointed out a new policy that the Obama administration is proposing to get the money back, the new bank fee that's in the president's budget plan. Some financial institutions, though, are taking matters into their own hands on this topic with bonus clawbacks. From New York, Marketplace's Jeremy Hobson explains.
A clawback is just like it sounds.
I paid you for doing something for me. You didn't do it in the right way. I want my money back.
That's Charles Elson, who directs the Weinberg Center for Corporate Governance at the University of Delaware. He says, in theory, a firm pays an employee after a good year of service. Here's how it might go.
And this one's for you, Jimmy. You made us a lot of money on that telecom deal.
Thanks, Mrs. Buckwinder.
But then, a year or two later, it turns out the telecom deal was a dud. In the long term, it goes sour.
Jimmy!
Yes, ma'am, Mrs. Buckwinder?
You'd better stop construction on that swimming pool. I'm taking your bonus back.
But, ma'am, we already ordered the raft with the margarita holders.
Sorry, too late.
That's how it would work in theory, to try to ensure that employees are not taking excessive risk in the short term at the expense of the long-term health of the company or the economy as a whole. But Charles Elson says it's not that simple in practice.
Legally, once the money has gone to someone, it's really hard to get it back because a lot of times when you pay money out, it's a result of a contract. And usually contracts are really, really hard to get out of.
And he says,
practically speaking, once you pay someone that money, typically they spend it. It's hard to get it back from them. You could get a judgment against them. But whether you're actually going to get the money back is another story because the money may have been long gone.
Up until recently, clawbacks were only used in the case of fraud or other illegal activity. Alan Johnson says using clawbacks to get money back from trades that go bad could be incredibly difficult because of the sheer number of trades that go bad at large firms. Johnson is a managing director of Johnson Associates, a compensation consultancy.
Large firms reorganize all the time. People change jobs, positions get hedged, and so forth. So to go back and say 2 or 3 years later that that was a bad trade, it's almost impossible.
That's not stopping the big banks from trying. Some Bank of America employees are opening pay packages now that for the first time include clawback provisions on deferred pay. J.P. Morgan and Morgan Stanley are doing likewise. And at Goldman Sachs and Citigroup, some top earners will be subject to clawbacks going forward. All this may sound great to lawmakers in Washington, but Alan Johnson says banks should be careful what they promise.
Because I tell clients that in the future, there will be a year where you lose money, and the regulator or the politicians will expect a list of witches that you've hunted down, and you better have a long list. And if you don't have a list, you're in big trouble, because you promised to go witch hunting, and where are the witches? I don't know how you run a firm then.
Charles Elson says if banks really want to make sure their employees are thinking in the long term, they should pay them over the long term. Then no clawback would be necessary.
The idea would be pay these bonuses in stock that hasn't vested, create a longer vesting period such that if there was any monkey business in the award of the stock can be taken away before it actually walks out the door, if you will.
But, of course, for the vast majority of Wall Street employees, getting paid only in stock is not an option. Even bankers need some cash to live in New York. And as one told me, unless every bank, brokerage, and hedge fund followed the same rules, many employees would just go work for the competition. In New York, I'm Jeremy Hobson for Marketplace.
Coming up, here's one way to score during the Super Bowl.
Create an ad. Get it aired on the Super Bowl. When the conservative group starts yelling and screaming, we're going to take them on.
But first, let's do the numbers. Wall Street tapped the brakes today. The Dow Industrials dipped 26 points, 0.25%, ended at 10,270. The Nasdaq edged up less than a point, though, just a fraction of 1%, closed pretty much where it started, 2190 at the bell. The S&P 500 shed 6 points, 0.5%, finished the day at 1,097. Retailer Ralph Lauren, or Lauren, I can never keep it straight. Anyway, the company stumbled on the Polo Grounds. Quarterly earnings failed to impress. Shares limped down 0.8%. Meantime, International Paper reported a loss of nearly $400 million. On its industrial packaging division. Investors thus took a chainsaw to the company's shares, lopping off about 5.5%. The world's top drug maker, Pfizer, said earnings this year probably will not meet expectations. The company's shares caught a cold, dropping 2.33%. Bonds fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 3.7%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Elance, where businesses can connect with programmers, designers, marketers, and other independent professionals to get jobs done. You can build a team online at Elance.com. What does setting interest rates have in common with driving a car? Visit the Marketplace whiteboard to find out. Our videos demystify finance and economics. Just go to our website, marketplace.org.
Mm-hmm.
from the Marketplace Statebook here to look at events coming up Thursday. The Commerce Department reports on factory orders for December. The House Oversight and Government Reform Committee discusses the sticky Toyota gas pedal situation. It looks at the federal government's response to the recall of millions of vehicles. Also in the House, a hearing on legislation that will protect school children from harmful uses of restraint and seclusion in their classrooms. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. Hugo Chavez is looking for some help from his friends. The Venezuelan president this week invited a team of Cuban energy experts to help Caracas deal with an ongoing power crisis. That's interesting on two counts. First, Cuba's not really known for having sound energy policies of its own. Also, Venezuela is one of the world's leading energy exporters. It ships out millions of barrels of crude oil every day. Commentator David Frum has just come back from a State Department-sponsored trip to Venezuela, and he sent along these observations about the curious state of its economy.
The campus of the Central University of Venezuela is a UNESCO landmark, a perfect example of the tropical modernism of the 1960s. I visited just a few days ago to talk to students and faculty and noticed something strange. Every clock in the building had stopped dead. I asked why. Answer, the 1980s vintage computer that controlled the clocks had failed, and the university could not obtain foreign currency to repair or replace it. It's not an unusual story in Venezuela. In the 5 days I spent there, I met middle-class professionals who had given up their cars for lack of imported spare parts. Next door, Colombia demands dollars for its coffee, so most Venezuelans must make do with brackish Nicaraguan brew. Those who have maintained illegal bank accounts in the United States smuggle scarce goods from Miami. It took an hour to load my flight as middle-class Venezuelans struggled to wedge their bags into the overhead bins. They won't check their luggage because, they explain, they fear the Caracas luggage handlers will rob them. Those who must use local currency lose one-third of their purchasing power to inflation every year, and in late January saw their savings cut in half by a devaluation. Electricity disappears for 2 hours a day outside the capital. Water taps run dry. In the single month of January, the Hugo Chavez government seized ownership of a major shopping mall and a large grocery chain, was caught shipping a boatload of missiles to Hezbollah, and ordered cable stations to drop the country's most popular TV station because it did not carry a long-winded presidential speech in full. It takes a certain kind of genius to lay waste to the economy of one of the world's major oil producers. But in his excuses, at least, Chavez is very far from original. He fixes the blame where it always goes, on the Americans and the Jews.
David Frum is a fellow at the American Enterprise Institute. Send us your comments and observations. It's marketplace.org. Click on that link that says contact. Just when you thought Super Bowl ads couldn't get any more controversial, well, they can't, at least not the ones you're going to see during the game. Not long after CBS agreed to run an anti-abortion spot this Sunday, paid for by Focus on the Family, it rejected an ad from Man Crunch. Yeah, no, I didn't know what it was either. It's a gay dating site, and it's getting a whole lot of free publicity, thanks to the dust-up, just not nearly as much as it planned for. Marketplace's Sean Cole reports.
This story is like a crazy onion that keeps unpeeling until you get to a pungent core of truth. It starts with this Man Crunch ad. Two guys in warring football jerseys are on a couch watching their teams battle it out.
10, 5, touchdown!
Oh, come on!
Yeah, that's what I'm talking about, baby!
They both reach into a bowl of potato chips. Their hands touch. And then they start ferociously making out.
I wanna kill!
Cut to the logo, mancrunch.com, where many, many, many men come out to play. The ad was submitted a couple of weeks ago by Man Crunch's owner, a Canadian group called Avid Life Media. And when CBS said the spot didn't meet broadcast standards for the Super Bowl, Avid Life cried discrimination.
It can't be the ad that's unacceptable, right? It's funny.
This is Noel Biederman, the president of Avid Life.
It's the kind of almost humorous thing you would see on Saturday Night Live. There's nothing wrong with the ad itself. What they don't like is the notion of the business behind it. And I think that's really what's going on.
A CBS spokeswoman told me the opposite. She said the network had other issues with the ad and that it would be open to working with Avid Life on alternative submissions. But soon, the blogosphere and some of the mainstream media began expressing doubts about Avid Life and its intentions.
They're feigning shock.
Steve Hall runs a blog called Ad Rants. He says there is now a rich history of marketers creating Super Bowl ads they know will be rejected. It's a ploy, he says.
You know, in any given meeting, at any given brand, at one point or another, someone, you know, speaks up and says, oh, you know, we should just create an ad that we know is going to get banned. And, you know, then we can upload it on the web and everybody will look at it. And, you know, we'll have all this free media exposure.
So at this point, I thought I'd really gotten to the crux. Media manipulation disguised as moral outrage. Except for one thing. Noel Biederman freely admits having had that conversation in his boardroom.
Make no mistake about it. We have bright guys in our company. They said, okay, you know, do we want this to be rejected, Noel? Should we make a really racy ad or whatever? And I was like, no.
That wasn't his goal, he says. And I tend to believe him, because he also says things like this.
I was going to shepherd myself. I was going to herald myself as the second coming of someone who's helping emancipate, you know, gay men into mainstream America. I know that sounds totally ridiculous.
That sounds ridiculous.
No, but it was around those notions.
This is the thing. Biederman did want a lot of buzz and controversy surrounding the ad, but only after it aired. The current controversy was just his plan B. Plan A went like this.
Create an ad. Get it aired on the Super Bowl. When the conservative groups that can't stand these people's way of life starts yelling and screaming, we're going to take them on. To the community then that we're then trying to make members of our service, we hopefully will look like heroes. If we do this right, we will then build a brand that lasts for the next decade.
Biederman wanted to be debating this ad on Bill O'Reilly-type talk shows until the next Super Bowl. That, he says, would have really gotten Man Crunch's name out there. It's still manipulation, but it's not disguised as anything. I'm Sean Cole for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, offering total return strategies designed to match your goals. This is Putnam Today. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note today from the Marketplace desk of, wait, what? Did you know that halftime entertainment at the Super Bowl doesn't get paid? Said so in the New York Times today. The paper says the National Football League figures all the attendant publicity around that game is payment enough. Really? Like The Who this year and Bruce Springsteen last year and the Rolling Stones and Prince and all of them? They need publicity? Really? Anyway, that's Marketplace from American Public Media this Wednesday. Today, the Dow dipped 26 points, 0.25%. The NASDAQ edged up less than a point, just a fraction of 1%. The S&P 500 gave back 6 points, 0.5%. Vahan Baladuni, Ravi Karman, Stephen Colon, Andrea Jackson, Gewurz, Eric Johnson, Jeff Peters, and Charlton Thorpe engineered the program for us. Tune in tomorrow morning to the Marketplace Morning Report for the latest in business and economic news. And next time on this program, you get laid off and then you get rehired, but you discover things just ain't like they used to be.
Not only do they receive this large cutback in hours, but we also find that these individuals take large cuts in their pay.
Tales from the underemployed. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.